Well, I'm going to shift here on you. I don't know about you, but I, like you, I think, have been making some observations over this last year, quite frankly, over the last year. And I think you would agree that you've probably made some observations too and have come to some perhaps conclusions on certain things as you've seen certain events unfold and take on certain manifestations. You've probably recognized certain things that in some cases don't make sense and some in some cases are contradictory and somehow kind of don't figure. And then there's other things that do figure and that you could expect. Yeah, I would fully expect that because of the circumstances being what they are. But I can't help, especially as we are now going toward the holy days, to think about an observation that has come home to me anyway, that has illustrated somewhat of a character weakness that all of us suffer from time to time, depending. You'll see what I mean as we go along here. Bear with me as I try to set this up and begin to lay down some groundwork with regard to the subject. But I believe that this observation, recognition of this character weakness, character flaw that we all suffer from time to time, believe it or not, and I know you're going to say, oh boy, here he goes again, but believe it or not, believe it or not, came to me as a result of the intense political environment that we're in, of all things. And you say, well, what? How does that happen, you know? Well, let me explain, because as I go through this, I want to certainly bring your attention to some parallels and associations that I hope this will be helpful in going forward, as I said, especially as we begin to approach Passover, the days of unleavened bread, and of course, even beyond that, Pentecost, as we all are expecting in the next few months as they unfold. What am I talking about? I'm talking about the Constitution of the United States. I'm talking about the Declaration of Independence. I'm talking about the Bill of Rights. These documents that are written, they're written for the purpose of providing and unleashing freedom and liberty like never seen before in the history of humanity. That's right, brethren. What we have here in the United States, as far as these documents are concerned, and follow me through this, as we see these documents and begin to try to understand them a little bit, we see that they are designed to unleash freedom of people's minds, of people's lifestyles, liberties that should invoke certain improvements of human rights and benefits from all of us to make a living, to become whatever we want to become, if we're willing to work for it. That's what these documents were all about, developing and essentially laying down certain guidelines and guardrails that afford us that if we stay within that path, within that route, within that lane, would indeed, if we abide by the rules of what these documents claim, provide us with certain freedoms and liberties and rights. And not only human rights, but God-given rights, because that's what's in the document. It's in the document. Inalienable rights, God-given to all of us. This is unlike any other nation, empire, kingdom in the history of the world. Even ancient Israel, brethren, did not have what the United States of America. Ancient Israel, under David and Solomon, was a monarchy. King. It's great to be king. You can have what you want, you know. King. And you had others that were in lower areas of operation within that particular government. Yes, this particular country and what we have going for us is truly unique in all of world history. Hard to believe this guy Thomas Jefferson gets tagged to go up to his house for about a couple weeks and develop a draft called the Declaration of Independence. 2 weeks, he hides out in his house. He comes out with a draft and takes it back to his four buddies, because it was a group of five guys, by the way, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, a guy named Livingston, and Roger Sherman. They were the five that essentially edited what Jefferson originally wrote. And when they kind of all put it there, Jefferson gets a lot of the credit, of course. But when they got it all together, then they submitted it to the Continental Congress of another 50 guys. And they got their hands on it. And they edited it. And what we have today is the Declaration of Independence, which was designed to make a statement. We don't want to be part of the Commonwealth of England anymore. We are a sovereign country. And we stand on our own two feet. And we are indeed a country. And that declaration essentially stated that, as well as provided certain freedoms and liberties, because it was intent to give us a sovereign separation that would give us liberties and freedoms that we wouldn't have under the Commonwealth, and intended, thirdly, for improving human rights. It was a good thing. The document was indeed then ratified later. And as many of us are well aware, July 4th, 1776, we became a nation born out of pain. Born out of pain, without a doubt. And by no means, no means, in any way, shape, or form, I think we've made some progress. But we have been, for sure, still aspiring to the very ambitious goals and hopes of what the documents, that I mentioned before, the Constitution as well, and the Bill of Rights as well, because you see, as time went on, those early forefathers realized, we need more words. We need more definition on what we're trying to aspire to, you know. So they come up with this Constitution. They come up with 10 amendments that we know as the Bill of Rights. And these documents were all designed, as I said, to provide the freedoms and liberties, as well as improvement of human rights, and, of course, the statement that we are now a separate nation. And by around 1791, we had all these documents in hand and pretty much laid out there for us to read, to study, to know, to understand. And that brought me to an observation that presented a question that was driving me to recognize this character weakness and flaw that I introduced to you before that I had not yet told you about. And the question was, first, let's put first things first. The question was, I wonder what our forefathers would think with the documents now in hand, 245 years later, fast forward to February 2021, what they would think of the legalization of pornography. What they would think of strip clubs on the corner in the neighborhoods where the men and women can go and watch females and males strip naked. Or how about it being illegal to read your Bible in school. I wonder what George Washington would think about that. Or Thomas Jefferson, if he were alive. Or Hamilton. Or even the beer guy, Samuel Adams. Drunk or sober, I bet he wouldn't agree with it. You know, making it illegal to pray in school? What would they think about these homosexuals legally marrying, passed by the Supreme Court that legislated from the bench, overriding state rights? What would they think? How far have we come? Where dost thou goest in this scenario, if you know what I'm saying? Transgender operations where a boy can change his, you know what's, to something else, a female genitalia, or vice versa. And it's legal. There are hospitals that are legally doing these kinds of operations. I wonder what our forefathers, John Hancock, Benjamin Franklin, Webster, these guys, these sages that this country was built on, would think of these kinds of things. Siphoning off funds from you, the taxpayers of the United States of America, and plugging them in to a globalist agenda and foreign countries of where, like, for instance, the Paris Climate Accord is now going to siphon money off of the United States taxpayer for programs that really are irrelevant to the United States of America, because guess what, brethren? We're already leading the world in reduction of pollution. If anything, China and India should be doing something. But these are things that I'm sure our forefathers would have some things to say about being associated with the World Court or the World Trade Corporation or with the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. I'm sure our forefathers would see a lot of concern in these areas and probably raise a hand or two with respect to just exactly what is indeed going on. You see, brethren, and I think this observation that I have been experiencing over the last year and watching certain things unfold and come to fruition the way they have, and you've seen these things too. One thing for sure, I've learned as a sidebar observation, this is still not that character weakness I'm talking about yet. Don't want to confuse you. I'm still walking this line here. But as a sidebar observation, I've realized that, you know what, and I think you have too, liberty and freedom is a very difficult thing to navigate. Because you see, we all have variations. All have variations of what is right and what is wrong. And therein lies the problem. Because as our forefathers said, and this is what we forgot, John Adams, and I'll remind you, I've said this before, but I'll remind you and those of you on the internet, our Constitution was made for only a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. You move off of ground zero, you move off of the absolutes, and guess what? Anything goes. What's good for you may not be good for me. What's good for me may not be good for you. But you know what? I got freedoms, and I've got liberties, so get out of my way and let me do my thing. And sadly, you see, when that begins to happen, we get confusion. As a result, because the absolutes are removed, as an airplane or any kind of flying machine, you have a certain gyro. If that thing gets out of whack, you don't know if you're upside down, right side up, going down, or what. You lose your bearing. If you have no reference point, if you have no means, a compass, to know where north is, where south is, where east or west is, and you lose your way. Our problem, because we're human and you remove these things, is in the heart. That's where it comes. The holy days begin to bring us back to reconsider a very important element of a type of education. Because you see, there's two types of education. I heard this first from Herbert W. Armstrong. I thought actually he was the one that was to be accredited with what I'm about to share with you. But I found out he was quoting a forefather. Or he got it from one of our forefathers. As a matter of fact, it was John Adams. And the two types of education I'm talking about is the one education that most of us, when we go to school, learn, and that is how to make a living. We learn how to make a living. We go to school, we take up math, we take up some vocation, and we learn to be a plumber, or we learn to be a mathematician or a scientist, or we take chemistry, we learn to work in the laboratory. We learn how to make a living through the familiarity of whatever's necessary to become part of a vocation, a career pursuit. Some of us are good with our hands, others of us are good with our heads. And then the second type of education, and that is how to live. How to live. A lot of people know how to make a good living, but they miss the mark terribly, miserably, on how to live. And that's important. A lot of good, very successful people that know how to make a living. Oh, they make big bucks, lots of money. And we tend to equate the fact of their physical, material success with them being good people. And we're sadly mistaken when we do that. How many do we know, movie stars, you know, for instance, or sports stars, athletes, that are just miserable in their lives? They've gone through multiple marriages. They are drug addicts or certain other types of problems that they have in their lives, and it's obvious that many of them, though they know how to make a good living, they don't know how to live. And so our nation, in all these foundational documents, all these things that we have here before us, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and of course, the Bill of Rights, and a lot of other additional amendments, all seem to give us an indication of how we should be able to abide by certain rules and regulations and behaviors and so on to give us what we would consider a happy life, a free life, a life that is hopefully got a lot of human rights associated with it. But unfortunately, because people don't know how to live, they take advantage of the system. And we've got our hands full of exploiters and scammers, don't we? The fact of, a day's work for a day's pay, strong families that are oriented toward people dedicated to God, to their jobs, are sometimes taken advantage of by the scammers and exploiters. Why? Because in and amongst many good people in the United States, in Canada, other parts of the world, get taken advantage of. But especially here in the United States, because you see, the way the laws read, they are very, very liberal in many respects. And consequently, you can get away with a lot of things like Bernie Madoff did. Made off with all that money. You can't make this stuff up. Name's Madoff. He made off with a lot of money, you know. Or you can do things like Mr. Weiner did on his laptop. Why? Because he's got freedoms. He knew how to make a living, but didn't know how to live. So it brings me to what you could say, I think, this clarity. And here's the parallel. Let me shift now. on you to the church. This clarity that with all these documents, there's something in common that is contributing to the failure. The failure. Because you see, the documents themselves that we see and have our forefathers have had access to, and we have access to, do not compensate for the lack of performance that we ourselves as a culture and nation suffer from. And yet we've got the documents, but yet we still suffer from illegalities, perversions, illicit behaviors, crime, all these things. And so the weakness that I'm talking about, because here we have, look at this. We've got a document much more comprehensive, far more comprehensive than the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and or the Bill of... This is far more comprehensive. Wouldn't you agree? This is a psychology book. I don't need to know how to read about how to be ambitious or how to be more performing. All I got to do is, the Bible tells me, look at the ant in Proverbs. I learn about how I should be in life by looking at the ant. And what does that mean? Does that sound insane? No. The Bible's talking about, look at the industrial attitude toward the approach the ant has. I watch my squirrels in my backyard, and every year I see them in the fall. When I get back from the feast, man, they are busier than one-armed coat hangers in the windstorm. They are running around the yard. They are burying every little nut in every little crook and cranny that they can bury, because guess what? I see them then later on in the winter out there going to the same places where they buried those nuts to get them, to bring them out, because they can't take them all up to their nest, unless it's my attic. But my point is, they are industrious, long-term oriented, always looking to the future to build something. And they're consistent. There's a continuum in their life. They are ambitious. Man, that's all the psychology I need to know. I take all those attributes, apply them in my life, and guess what? I've got it made in the shade, or at least I should if I work hard and treat people right. But there is what I'm talking about. You see, what is lacking, brethren, and how this shifts now to the church is the fact that we all suffer from one thing, from this one thing from time to time, and that is the application of what we know to do, and we don't do it. Goes back to Romans 7, where it plugs in to the Apostle Paul, where he says, you know, I just can't seem to do the things I should do. I know what I should do. I know how to do this. But somehow I just fail to find the will in me to get up in the morning and go to work. So I jump from job to job to job to job to job. Or I can't kick this smoking habit. So I keep buying the cigarettes. Well, don't buy the cigarettes. See how that works. Change the patterns. But see, we don't. If you want to change the cycles, as I've often said, you got to change the patterns. You don't, as Einstein said, because that's the definition of insanity, continue to repeat the same things that you do and expect different results. Because guess what? It won't happen. If you keep doing the same thing over and over and over, guess what you do? You get the same results. You get the same results. So you got to change up the patterns. You got to change up the behaviors and try to shake it up a little bit to make something different happen. Over here, in the book of James. Let me take your attention over here to the book of James, chapter 1. Jesus' half-brother launches into this premise that he later on goes into with regards to different fruits of the Spirit and fruits of the flesh. But over here in chapter 1, he sets a premise right out of the box almost in this book. He says, verse 22, "But be you doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass, for he beholds himself and goes his way and straightway forgets what manner of man he was. But whoso looks into the perfect law of liberty," key word here, this Greek word continues, means remains, be permanent, persevere, abide. In other words, you have to develop some consistency. You can't be, as my mom used to say, an on-again, off-again Flanagan. You got to be consistent. You want to be successful in a career? Then pursue it like a hungry lion and go for it. And regardless of the cost, be willing to pay the sacrifices necessary to get whatever the education is that you've got to get, or make the move that you've got to make in order to be where you got to be, to make what you want to do work and happen. But along the way, as you pursue your goals, dreams, and ambitions, don't forget how to live. That's important. That's important. That you don't let the stresses, the anxieties, the heartache, the hurt, failures, maybe even along the way, or betrayals along the way, to get you to forget how to live. Don't let that happen. And there are a lot of distractions. You know it as well as I do. I've had them in my life, and I know you've probably had them in your life, where these distractions can be sometimes so overwhelming that they do sometimes knock us off the saddle, and we do end up forgetting how to live. And we end up going off the rails, living a different way that we shouldn't be living, only to find out that that just exacerbates the prevention of us achieving the goals and knocks off our continuity. It knocks off our consistency and delays us, detours us, and depending on how deep the hole we allow ourselves to get into occurs, could even ruin the whole track you were on and all the sacrifice you've made along the way. So here, James is very clear about this. Look, he says, this is the key. Whoso looks into the perfect law of liberty, and this liberty we're talking about is the liberty from the death penalty ultimately, the liberty of being able to be born into God's kingdom as a spirit being, this liberty that James has in his mind that he's framing these words from is the ultimate liberty. So if that liberty, he says here, is that important, which it is, he says, the perfect law of liberty, and continues therein in that way of living that will provide you with that liberation of the resurrection ultimately, he, being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man shall be blessed in his doings. That's what James is saying in this regard. So what he's basically reminding us of is we have a declaration of independence. We do, as Christians. We have a declaration of independence. And we also have a constitution to abide by. I'll shift the word, though, from constitution, because that's kind of secular, to covenant. Our covenant with Jesus Christ to God the Father is the constitution we Christians ought to be abiding by and living by, and is defined in both Old and New Testament in all of its detail and for all of the awareness we need in order to be good Christian people. And there's a lot of truth in the book of Proverbs. You know, just I was mentioning about the ant and so many things about complaining and wisdom and all the things that are in the book of Proverbs is just chock full of information that we can implement, deploy in our lives to make us better people, wiser people, more successful people in so many regards. Over here in the book of Galatians, let's go back here again, here in this case, the Apostle Paul speaking to those Christians in Galatia. And this is the one that I was mentioning about the fruits of the Spirit. I had confused with James before, but here in Galatians, Paul mentions this. Over in verse 12, let me jump into the context. Verse 13. For brethren, this is chapter 5, book of Galatians, verse 13. You have been called unto liberty, only use not your liberty for an occasion to the flesh. You know, just because you have God's grace, and remember back in the day here, there were people who thought, well, hey, if you sin more, you get more God's grace, that means you'll secure your condition of being saved more securely. No, that's fallacious reasoning. Fallacious reasoning. And so what Paul here is reminding us for is that though we know that we are in God's grace, and we know that the death penalty has no more claim on our lives, because as we know, going into Passover, we're accepting Jesus Christ's blood and atonement for us instead, so that we don't have to pay that death penalty. He died for us and our sins and took the hit for us that we might live. Because we know all of that, that's a liberty. That's liberation. That's a liberating thought to know that death has no claim on you anymore. But Paul is warning us, because it's not a once saved, always saved doctrine. That's fallacious. You're rewarded, brother. You're saved by grace, without a doubt. But you're rewarded by works. And you can lose your salvation, for sure. That's another subject for another time. He goes on here in verse 13, only use not your liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word. And Paul references the royal law that James talks about. I didn't quote it, I think, over there in chapter 4 of the book of James, where he says here, in this particular case, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's the royal law that James talks about. Same thing. Jesus said these two commandments the law rests on, right? He said, love God first with all your might, quoting right out of the Old Testament. And then he said, to treat each other as you yourself would want to be treated. Now, he wasn't eliminating the other commandments. He was just saying, in summation, the law hangs on these two things. The first four of the commandments rests on the love of God. The latter six rests on the love you should have for your fellow man, the courtesies and considerations that you should extend to them in the way you're living, in the way that you're living. That's important, that you live along those lines. And so he says here, but if you bite and devour, this is verse 15, chapter 5, book of Galatians, if you bite and devour one another, take heed, that you be not consumed one of another. This I say then, walk. It means to occupy yourself. Just immerse yourself. Go underwater. I mean, become so much a part of this. Embed yourself into these principles. That's what he's talking about. This I say then, walk in the Spirit. Embed yourself in it. And you shall not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. Why is that? Because that's the defense of the lusts of the flesh. If you immerse yourself in the fruits of the Spirit and activate yourself constantly in the fruits of the Spirit, the fruits of the flesh won't have the impact, won't have the effect on you, because you will be so occupied with the fruits of the Spirit, there won't be any time for you to be engaging in those things that contradict that particular direction, because it's then and only then we get into trouble when we let ourselves go off those rails and let the flesh come in to place and detour us or create an obstruction for us and delay us in our pursuit for being better people. Verse 17, he says, for the flesh lusts against the Spirit, Spirit against the flesh. These are contrary, the one to the other, so that you cannot do the things that you would do. And that goes right back to Romans. Paul's commentary to the Romans, chapter 7, as I already referenced, and it's very consistent. There's a continuum here. Paul's story never changes. He's always talking along the same themes, different ways in some cases, because the people were different in these locations. But in principle, you can see these principles are always illuminated along the same lines to help us find the reinforcement, the comprehension, because maybe you can understand the book of Galatians a little bit better than the book of Romans. But they're all, in some respects, in likeness to one another because the themes are very consistent in their articulation as well as in their appeal for application. Chapter 8, 1 Corinthians, a situation of how one should be exercising a way of life in a courtesy and considerate fashion to others. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here. I can't go line upon line simply because I just don't have that time. But in summation here, what Paul's talking about in verse 4, as you can see, he's talking about, and this is the SPS of this chapter, concerning therefore the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice unto idols. So Paul has a conflict going on with some Christians coming out of the pagan religions who would go down to the market, the shambles, and get blue light specials on meat. And they would get discounts and so forth and take it home and they would eat it. But these meats were perhaps offered unto idols in some respects. They were taken from religious activity and then sold to the in the market to the public. And a lot of Christians coming in, you come to my house, and I've got one of these meats that perhaps were previously part of a religious ceremony, and you might have a problem with that. And Paul is saying, boy, you know, I wish everybody had the understanding that you, like you, you know, if we had a Christmas tree up here, and remember Bath, Ohio, how we had services, we'd have a Christmas tree on the stage for a good month or so, you know. But it doesn't defile us. I mean, that's just the way it is. We rented the space, so we had nothing to do with it. When we first came here 2 years ago, we had a big cross. Remember that big cross on the wall? It didn't mean anything to us. A lot of people, in some cases, and sadly, even in God's church, their conscience is so bothered by, and I've talked to people like this, that they won't even, in some cases, come into the building or go on the property because there's a statue of some kind of a, you know, a traditional edifice of Christianity, be it a cross or be it Jesus with long hair and a beard or whatever it may be. They won't even go to services because they don't want to go on the property with something like that in their presence. Paul is speaking to that issue. I wish everyone was of this opinion that, you know what, eat the meat and enjoy it. The idol means nothing. We know that it's not a god. It means nothing. It's senseless. You got a benefit. You got a deal on the meat. Eat it. Enjoy it, you know. But, unfortunately, as we see here, the meat, he says, but take heed, verse 9, but take heed, lest by any means this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to them that are weak. Whoa! So what Paul's saying here is, put on the brakes, because even though you're liberated in your conscience of this fact that you can eat this meat, or you can go have a beer, or have a shot of whiskey, or whatever you might want to do, you can do certain things in your mind that you believe you have the liberty to do, maybe even on a Sabbath day. Because you've got little kids, you do something on the Sabbath, playing with them, whatever, taking them to the beach. And I'm not going to, you know, basically cross swords here with what you can and can't do on the Sabbath, but there are things, let's face it, that some of us would do on the Sabbath that others of us wouldn't. Case in point, some won't even go to a restaurant on the Sabbath day. Amongst us, in our culture, they view that as a no-no. They can't go to a restaurant. They can't go buy food or into a place, a propriety of sort that has drink and food and pay money for a meal. Brown bag it? Absolutely, they can do that. They'll you know, make their lunch or their dinner before and then come to services and they'll have, you know, maybe a brown bag and get together and eat around a table like downstairs. But what I'm saying here, brethren, is that there are some people that have differences of approaches toward these things that we ourselves may not agree with and take liberties to do other things that might offend them. And what Paul is saying, be cautious. be considerate. Be courteous. Don't judge one another. If you're going out and you know the individual has a drinking problem, but you don't, well, don't go drinking a beer in front of them. I mean, if you know that, I remember the story of a man in God's church, dating a girl who had been 15 years sober. She was an alcoholic. And he started dating her. And he told her, go ahead, you can drink. You got God's Holy Spirit now. You're baptized. You can drink. She said, no. I know. Believe me, I know. I start drinking. It's like magic. I find that old magic feeling, you know, and I go down that rabbit hole, you know. He said, no. You can do this. You got God's Spirit. Well, guess what? She did, and she started drinking. Went out of God's church for a while, but then came back. And I'm happy to say today is still in God's church. But you don't do those things. That's a direct opposition right here. Paul's saying, look, take heed, verse 9, lest by any means your liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to them that are weak. For if any man see you, which have knowledge, sit and meet in the idol's temple, shall not his conscience of him which is weak be emboldened or be edified, educated, to eat those things which are offered to idols? And through your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? In other words, this goes back to what Romans 14 is talking about with regards to the fact of what is not of faith is sin. If you force your brother by virtue of the liberties that you take in front of him, and you're comfortable with it, but he's not or she's not, and you take that liberty and impose it upon them, and then they go ahead and start doing it and sear their conscience as a result and fall into that category, because there's three categories of what sin is, brethren. One is what's not of faith is sin. To know to do right and not to do it is sin. And transgression of God's law, which we're all familiar with, is sin. Those three, they're all in your Bible. 1 John, James, and Romans. And those are important recognitions of what sin is and that we need to understand. This is all part of knowing how to live. It's one thing to know how to make a living, yes, but how to live is key. And what underscores how to live, as I said, if you didn't get it the first time, here's what I'm talking about. That character weakness is the application of knowing what is right to do and doing it. And doing it. That's the big difference. Because you see, if you don't do it, this oven by itself is not going to cancel out the decline in performance. The knowledge of this stuff does not prevent the decline of performance. What does affect the decline in performance is applying this knowledge, applying it. That's the problem with our country today. We don't apply the rules and regulations of our Constitution. You have a senator or a congressman engaged in managing an impeachment trial when the Constitution is clear that the only one that can do that is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And oh, by the way, fundamentally, you can't impeach a private citizen of the United States. Oh, it's right there. If they're not in office, you can't impeach them. Well, it doesn't matter. What? What do you mean it doesn't matter? You don't apply it. You get confused. And everybody turns into bumbling clowns. They do. They make fools of themselves in light of the word. That word was the Constitution. But again, Christians, here's the parallel, brethren, shift. Those that know and don't make fools. They do make fools of themselves, knowing full well that this is what needs to be abided by. And so we fall. We get up. We ask God forgiveness. True, right, and good. And that is the way to do it. And then move forward. And thank God, brethren, we have a Passover year after year that can dust us really clean again, just like when you came up out of the waters of baptism, and be refreshed and renewed. And that's why each and every one of us need the Passover. For those of us who are baptized, we really do need to take this coming Passover that is coming up upon us here shortly. Book of Ephesians, Paul writing here to this church, chapter 4, book of Ephesians, verses 1 through 6. Here's a challenge to all of us. I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of your vocation, wherewith you are called. This is a career opportunity. To be a Christian, it's a career. It's a lifestyle. It is the way you are. When I played drums, I never really was satisfied that I knew the song until I could, I know this might sound silly, but nevertheless, it was my habit, that until I knew the song so well that I could play that drum beat and be thinking about something else. I could sit back there, relax, hit my licks, and Tim would do things on the piano, and I would be on beat and thinking about the feast. Or thinking about something. It is something, brethren, that is so ingrained in you, embedded in you, that it's like breathing. This way of life. That's the way it should be. We need to get there. We need to get there. Passover helps us, certainly. But Paul mentions, hey, this is just that. It's a vocation wherewith you have been called. Verse 2, chapter 4, book of Ephesians. With all lowliness and meekness, with longsuffering, forbearing one another in agape. In other words, long-suffering. Be patient with each other. You don't understand something, or you think you understand something, and you think, well, that doesn't sound like him, or that doesn't sound like her. Pick up the phone and call them. Find out. Maybe you're misinterpreting them. Give them a chance to come to respond and reciprocate, and just in case you're misreading what they're saying. Or what they said on the phone didn't seem right, call them back and make sure you clarify. But it says here, be long-suffering. In other words, be patient with each other. And with this objective, verse 3, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. So if we do have differences, the objective is, even if we have to come to agree, we disagree, at least we can be friends. We can be civil. We can still have harmony. We can still be at peace with one another. We might not be best friends. We might not, you know, go out with each other, but at least we can be civil with each other, and we can work with each other if need be. I can't tell you how many guys and women I've worked with that I really just didn't like. But guess what? You got a job to do, you get along. You do what you got to do. And consequently, you make adjustments so that you can get the mission accomplished, whatever that mission may be on the job. In my case, it was water treatment systems, and we built them and managed them, and that was what our mission was. And I have to admit, all the people I worked with in getting that done, I wasn't best friends with. It's much fun. It's a whole lot better and much more fun if you like the people you're working with. Don't get me wrong, you know. And that is the objective to try to achieve, for sure, without a doubt. But sometimes it can't happen. Sometimes it just can't happen. There's conflicts. There's personality incompatibilities. But so be it. Try to get along as best you can. Verse 4. There's only one body, one spirit, called to one hope. Your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, the Father of all, who's above all, and through all, and in you all. But unto every one of us is given grace according to the measure of the gift of Christ. Dropping down now to verse 17 for the sake of time. This I say, therefore, or he shifts, he says, okay, therefore I say this, and testify in the Lord, that you henceforth, here's that word again, walk not as other Gentiles walk. In other words, don't occupy yourself like a heathen. Don't be that way. Don't act that way. You know better. All of us as Christians, we've got the document. We've got the Bill of Rights, the Constitution. We've got the Declaration of Independence here, speaking in metaphor. We've got, brethren, something far greater than that, secularly speaking, because we've got right here the covenant, the definition of the covenant of eternal life. But the key and the observation, let me remind all of you again that I'm talking about here, the key to this character weakness that has finally come to my mind over this last year in seeing, believe it or not, the non-performance and ineptness of our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and Declaration of Independence not engaged or abided by, illustrated to me a parallel association with the failure of we as Christians from time to time lack the character of applying these words, which are far more important than any of the documents that underscore this country's existence. And as Christians, for the long term, we have a major, major responsibility as Christians, because this defines your right and my right to access immortality for becoming kings and priests in God's kingdom. That's real. That's not just warm and fuzzy stuff. That's your destiny. That's my destiny. It's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping to be a teacher in the millennium, for starters. And then I don't know what thereafter. But once I get into the millennium, I know I'm home free. And you are too. Because we're spirit at that time, if we make it in that first resurrection. And we help Christ rebuild the earth, rebuild the waste spaces, as the prophecies tell us. And we bring those who were from the United States and in this culture of those birthrighted nations over there to Israel to commence the millennium with the new Israel in Palestine to be the shining light on the hill, the city on the hill that Israel was always intended to be but failed miserably to ever become, as the United States has failed in its ambitious statements that its Constitution states we have a right to in regards to that. So we have a lot of responsibility as Christians, a destiny that certainly is worth doing the best we can to accomplish and complete. And as here Paul is saying, continuing here in verse 18, having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling have given themselves over to the lusts of the flesh, lasciviousness, to work all uncleanness with greediness, in this case, and he goes on, but you have not so learned Christ. So he's putting the brakes on. He gives you this contrarian perspective, and then he puts the brakes on. He says, whoa, you have not learned that. Now, maybe that's the way you were. Understandable. We all got our baggage. We've all come from different directions and locations, metaphorically speaking. The lifestyles we live, the things we battle, and the times when we were kids, the way we were brought up. Some of us are still untangling from the psychoses that we grew up with as a result of being brought up in certain ways or abused in certain ways. But Paul is saying here to those Christians in Ephesus, look, you have not learned Christ that way. So put all that to the side. You went under the waters of baptism and you're coming up. Brethren, you're going to take the blood and the body of Christ in about 5 weeks, by the way. It's coming on us fast. 5 weeks. And guess what? You will be again refreshed and revived for, again, a new start. You need to take the Passover if you're baptized. Very important for all Christians to rededicate their lives to the commitment they have with the Father through Christ, accepting Him as the sacrifice. And so here, as I close up, in verse 21, it says here, so you've not learned Christ, verse 20, verse 21. If so, and I put this word be in quotes, be that you have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus. Verse 22, that you put off, put that in quotes too, concerning the former conduct, the old man, which is corrupt. Put it to the side. Forget about it. Don't look at it. Can't go forward looking in the rearview mirror. That's what I learned at Rex Humbard's church when I was looking for God's truth. That was one more. That's one thing that just stuck in my head. You know, he said from the lectern in the pulpit there, he says, you just can't go forward looking in the rearview mirror. And you can't. And Paul's saying it right here. You can't go forward looking in the rearview mirror, he says here. That's the old man, which was corrupt according to the deceitful lust. Verse 23, be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man, which after God is created in righteousness and true holiness. Wherefore, then he lists a whole bunch of things to put off, and then he comes down, verse 30, don't grieve the Holy Spirit, whereby you're sealed. Let all the bitterness, in verse 31, go away. You know, wrath and anger and clamor and evil speech, put it away, he says. And all malice, put it away. And 32, and I put be again in quotes. And be. This is the way we need to apply. We need to do this. And that's what goes back to what we talked about in the beginning there in James chapter 1, where we need to be doers so that we can be blessed in our doing. And he says, and be you kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. If I've learned anything in my Christian walk, brethren, over the years, I've learned not to jump too quickly. I've learned, and I'm thankful I can say this, to go back and recomb a little bit. And rather than impute motive or come to a conclusion on something about somebody, before I do that, now, granted, I fail occasionally from time to time, without a doubt, I'm not perfect. But I am happy to say I've kind of learned this. When I was younger, I was much quicker to react. But I've learned to be a little patient and confirm, do some vetting, do some qualifying, do some confronting. Do some talking with one another if indeed a divisive thing emerges. And be sure you understand what is really going on with the individual that you've got a difference with. And oh, by the way, don't forget, tell them you got the difference. They may not know there's a difference between you. You know, some people are not mind readers. If you got some problem with a person, at least give them the courtesy to say, you know what, you really offended me the other day when you said that. And you might find them, I did? I didn't realize that. What did I say? You know, you might find that happen. And then lo and behold, you're making all these things up in your mind, straw men, thinking, you know, you're getting madder and madder and madder at the person. The person didn't even know he offended you. So give them the courtesy. Give them the consideration to at least confront them and say, you know what? I know you're not a mind reader. I'm saying that funny. That's my humor. But let me tell you, you know, what you offended me on. And tell them. Tell them what you offended them on. But Paul here is very clear, brethren, that we ourselves are engaged in something that is very responsible. Christianity is an enormous responsibility. It does indeed have extreme consequences if indeed we are Christians that don't apply what we know to apply. Why do I say that? Because you can hurt people. In Christianity, you get to know people pretty well. And relationships are easy to cross swords with. And that's why it's always important to cloak ourselves in courtesy and consideration as we go forward. Let me close real quick. I just had another thought. Philippians chapter 2. Real fast here, brethren, because it's so very important that in the way we're living and knowing how to live, we keep these things in mind. Verse 3, chapter 2, book of Philippians 2, verse 3, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, ego. Don't do that. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. That's key. We need to, as we go about finding our way on how to live, brethren, and as we proceed to renew our covenant in baptism, as we go along that way, to always keep in mind on how we're living, but also out of the courtesies of our own thinking minds, being aware of whether or not we are treating others like we ourselves want to be treated. That's important. So learn by the observation, I think, that we are certainly exposed to, that we need to apply what God's Word tells us is the right thing to do in our lives and be the doers that you should be so that you can be blessed, as Paul said, in our doings.